Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you're listening. Welcome back to AI and the Future of Work. This is your host, Dan Turchin, Advisor at Insight Finder, System of Intelligence for IT Operations, and CEO of PeopleRain, the AI platform for IT and HR employee service. Thanks again to all of our listeners for helping us turn this passion project into one of the most downloaded podcasts about the future of work. If you like what we do, and I hope you do, please like, comment, and share in your favorite podcast app. Your feedback means a ton to us, really valuable. Keep listening, and we will keep bringing you amazing guests and interesting stories. You've heard us use the cliche on this show that AI is the new UI and voice is the new app. Some of the most innovative new applications I've seen in, I'll say, the past 6 months amplify the power of voice and fix traditional problems with, call them, prehistoric text input methods like keyboards and mice. For example, very successful companies like Chorus and Gong analyze the performance of sales reps using voice analytics, and others like NICE and Verint do similar things for contact center agents. Companies like Otter, Rev, and Dialpad, which we'll learn about today, transcribe meetings and create action items. These are very hard AI problems. They require massive amounts of data, the right approach to bias detection, human-in-the-loop reviews, and also a heavy focus on data privacy and security. Today's guest knows how to take solutions like this to market better than almost anyone on the planet. Dan O'Connell founded TalkIQ back in 2017 after more than a decade at Google and also at AdRoll. TalkIQ was subsequently acquired by Dialpad in 2018, and Dan has overseen the company's growth in a crowded space ever since. Today, we have the pleasure of getting to learn about the challenges of being a venture-backed founder, but also about the power of voice as a technology. Dialpad became a unicorn last year, having raised $100 million at a $1.2 billion valuation. Dan's a big reason why savvy investors like Andreessen Horowitz and Google Ventures are betting big on the future of Dialpad. Without further ado, Dan, my pleasure to welcome you to the podcast. Let's get started by having you share a little bit about your background and how you got into this space.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. I appreciate it. It's a very kind intro. Yes, it was really interesting to get into the space. I had started my career at Google in sales. I was there for about a decade. And quickly, as you learn, kind of building and managing sales organizations and customer support or service organizations is just the impact of every day people have conversations and every day businesses are trying to figure out how to sell more and how to churn less. And it really became evident that if you could start to understand what was happening within these conversations, you could go and solve those problems. I was fortunate to join an incubator here in San Francisco called Atomic. I met two technical co-founders, Jim Palmer and Etienne Mandersheed, who had really the idea for TalkIQ. And then it was really about how do we build a startup that can help us understand these conversations in real time. And so Etienne and Jim, I view them as really pioneers in the space of they really built the first real-time speech recognition engine that was specific for long-form audio, which is, you know, live conversations that are happening. And long-form meaning it's not like talking to Siri or Alexa and saying, hey, Siri, you know, play a song for me or whatever it might be. This is 45-minute conversation. How do you unpack and understand that conversation? And so really that was, it kind of naturally led me to this space was, hey, I got to figure out how to sell more and churn less. That was what I was doing as a role. And then here were these technologies when you get into speech recognition and NLP that can solve what I think are some pretty immense opportunities and challenges.
Surprise you most about your entrepreneurial journey?
Great question. What surprised me most, I think figuring out where to focus and where to spend time, it took me a long pause to kind of think about that. I think, you know, when we were building TalkIQ, you're a small startup. We had raised about $22 million in funding. We had about 15 employees at the time. You have an immense, there are almost so many different problems to go and solve for. And let me take a step back. When we're building TalkIQ and we said, hey, we want to understand conversations, we basically had to build three different things. We had to build our own telephony platform, which is how do we actually get onto a call path and understand conversations. So that was number one. Two is we then had to go and do the transcription of, let us go take audio and transcribe it to text. And then the third piece gets into the natural language processing piece, which is the NLP of the understanding. Those are three startups in one startup. And then you get into, let's go figure out product market fit, how to market and talk about this, how to drive sales. So I think that the hardest piece is making sure, like, you, as a startup, you don't have infinite resources. So you've got to make the right decisions on what to build and when to build them in terms of prioritization. And then making sure that you're not ahead of your skis in terms of marketing and sales motions. So really focusing on the product market fit. And I think the product market fit for us, is pretty easy in terms of the opportunity and the problem that we were solving in a massive market. But I think initially some of the hardest things were making that prioritization around where to focus and what to build and what features and where do you actually look for a potential partner. And that's part of the reason that we got into an acquisition and did a partnership as well, was around kind of opportunities to solve some of the problems or challenges that we were facing.
Conventional wisdom is that it takes about 10 years for a startup to achieve escape velocity, and you achieved it much quicker than that. What was the decision process like to be acquired?
Yeah, so a good one on that. So we had just raised, we had just closed our Series A. So it's kind of an interesting timing. And as I said, you know, we were a startup that was basically building three different startups of, hey, let's go figure out how to capture audio, which means we got to go build this telephony part. We've got to do the transcription piece and then the NLP piece. And so we had just closed our Series A. We had raised an additional $14 million led by Salesforce Ventures and Scale Ventures. And then we were trying to figure out distribution, which gets into, hey, how do we get out and get this technology in the hands of as many people as possible? So we had done a partnership with Dialpad. That partnership actually started kind of 18 years ago when I started my career. One of the founders of Dialpad was actually the first engineer that I sat next to at Google. And so I had called up Brian Peterson and said, hey, we've got this really great technology. You guys have a communication and collaboration product. We think that we can add a lot of value through a partnership. Allows you to have a different narrative and a different opportunity. And so that partnership then turned into an acquisition offer of Craig Walker, who's the CEO of Dialpad, coming to say, hey, have you guys ever thought about selling the business? And we hadn't. As I said, we had literally just taken, you know, we had years of runway. As I said, we had about $20 million in the bank and, you know, 16 employees. So it was a hard, tough conversation, both with our investors of, hey, why do we think this is a great path forward for us? Obviously, the investors are thinking about it from an economic standpoint. We were thinking about it in terms of an opportunity. You know, what's the opportunity cost? Can we do this ourselves? What does the competition look like? You mentioned Chorus and Gong at the beginning of the podcast. We had all raised our seed and Series A at the same time. So we were all very early stage companies. And for us, it was really, look, we thought that the biggest market out there was the unified communications market. So the UCaaS market, which is basically, you know, video conferencing, cloud telephony, and then the contact center market. And we thought that, look, if I think out in the future, to me, I viewed the world where speech recognition and NLP are living and breathing in our communication and collaboration suites, that I didn't view them as separate features of software. And so then we felt that, you know, we obviously, the economics of the deal made sense for us, but we felt that both businesses were actually stronger together than they were independently in the long term. And so again, kind of an early, quick decision on that, but it made sense from an economic standpoint, but also what I thought about what the future looked like. And I think Craig and Brian, who are the founders of Dialpad, saw that same vision.
So last week, Zoom pays about $15 billion for, yeah, Five9 in a related space. It's a super hot space. We've seen just stratospheric valuations for companies like Chorus and Gong. Talk to us about the differentiation of Dialpad in the market, and then also about the better together story of TalkIQ plus Dialpad.
Yeah, so the way we've always seen the market and what's unique for Dialpad is, so we're a cloud communications and collaboration suite. So we power voice, video, messaging, contact center on any device anywhere in the world. So We don't use any third party. I classify us and always talk about us as we're most like Apple in the space in terms of, if you think of Apple, they design their own hardware and they design their own software. So they have some efficiencies in innovation that they can do that are tough to replicate. And so we view ourselves as the same as them, meaning we don't use any third party APIs. We don't white label any software. We build everything ourselves, from the UI to the APIs to the telephony network to all of our own speech recognition and NLP. So it is, you've got a business that owns its whole tech stack, and that gives us advantages, and built in the cloud, and that gives you advantages in terms of innovation and deployment. And then what's different for us is it's a single pane of glass, meaning our view of the world, especially today, is that you shouldn't buy different pieces of software for your communication and collaboration needs. And you see it today. Some people are on Slack for team messaging, and then they might be on, you know, one of our competitors might be on Cisco or Avaya to hit, you know, you've got a desk phone tied to you for that. And then you hop into something else for video meetings. And our view of the world of where this all goes is, look, you should have a single piece of software, a single experience that works on any device, and that experience is the same for voice, video, messaging, and then how you support and sell. So how you service your users and how you sell to more of your prospects and opportunities. And then that should be, as I said, intelligent, meaning AI or speech recognition and NLP should be naturally seamlessly integrated within it. So our differentiation in the market is really that, which is, you know, we own our whole stack, and then we do all of our own artificial intelligence and speech recognition to make it a smart platform.
Talk us through a deal that you recently closed at Dialpad, just so we understand kind of your target customer profile and the target customer persona within that customer.
Yeah, so we sell, as you mentioned, we're, you know, a very fast growing business. We grow about 50% year over year. We've crossed the $100 million ARR mark. Some of the fastest, best brands in the world utilize Dialpad today. So we always like to highlight our friends at Twitter and WeWork, Uber, Stripe, HubSpot. And I always think, if you can go and win brands like that, which I think are really, you know, those are all brands we probably shake our heads to and say, yeah, I recognize those brands. If you can go and win those brands, and those brands say, hey, this is how we're going to power our communications and collaborations, especially today where so many of us are working in different locations, I think that has really trickled down effects in terms of how that shakes out and kind of defines a market. But we also work with very small businesses. So if you were to break our revenue up into kind of thirds, a third, a thirds, break it up by segments, it's pretty much a third, a third, a third in terms of we work with SMBs, mid-market and enterprise businesses of all shapes and sizes. We like to talk about ourselves as having incredible kind of breadth and diversity in terms of our customer base.
How do you sustain three different go-to-markets from an organizational perspective?
Yeah, it's a challenge. You know, you can't see me smile and laugh on this, but it's a hard thing. The nice thing for us is, you know, a lot of what we're talking about, I think we're fortunate in terms of we're in a space where, you know, it's not necessarily rocket science, meaning we're talking about, hey, let's make phone calls. Let's make sure, you know, you can do text messaging or team messaging, video. So the talking about the product, I don't think is terribly complex, right? Some of the underlying technologies or questions that might come up from the CIO or the IT buyer might be in the weeds a little bit. But I think the nice part about having one team and we organize around having one set of account executives that sell the product suite. So there is some complexity in terms of all the things they need to know. I think fortunately we're in an area that's not terribly complex to talk about in terms of, hey, we're talking about voice video. We're not talking about you know, database infrastructure and things that might get a little bit more complex from a technological standpoint.
One of the challenges of selling NLP technology into the enterprise is, I know firsthand, is that as consumers, we get very skewed perspectives of the quality of NLP from interactions with Siri, Alexa, Google Assistant, et cetera. They have such an unfair data advantage that it's impossible to appreciate that in the enterprise, we're trying to solve a small data problem. When you were TalkIQ, a startup, you mentioned you and your co-founders and, you know, kind of one of the three startups that you were building was around NLP. What were some of the challenges of taking NLP to market for the enterprise?
Yeah, so I'll tie this back. I think there's two challenges when you talk about kind of AI technologies and specifically speech rec and NLP. One is I think we have outsized expectations from reality, right, of understanding we're still in the very early innings of what these technologies can kind of do. You know, you can look back at Captain Kirk on, you know, the original Star Trek would be talking to commands to his computer then. So we obviously knew that this was going to happen and voice was going to be an input for our devices and all of that. But I think there's challenges around setting appropriate expectations with people to make sure that the buyer doesn't believe in the minority report of the future and understands kind of where we are today. And then two is it's a data problem. And when I talk about this and you bring up a good point was, part of the reason we also went through the acquisition was if you're trying to do speech recognition, you're trying to do just audio to text, and you're trying to do that really well. Well, voice has almost infinite problems, meaning you and I will enunciate words differently. You and I will speak at different cadences. You and I, you can't see us. You're on a headphones. I'm using AirPods. There will be differences with noises in the background, proximity to mics, you name it. So this all comes down to how do you get as much data as possible to go and build and train models? Dialpad as a telephony provider has access to an immense, vast trough of training data. And so we work with our customers. Our customers opt in to share their data with us to help improve their speech recognition and then their NLP models. And we actually deploy models for every business that we work with. They're customized language and acoustic models because that's a fancy way of saying, look, there are words that are unique to every business that they work with, whether it's industry jargon to product names to competitor names to you name it. We go and build a custom model for them so they get the highest accuracy in the industry in terms of working with Dialpad.
So there are kind of two sub problems with NLP, or I should say with voice recognition. One is transcription, which is another one of the three startups that that was TalkIQ. But the other one is interpreting and making automated decisions based on an understanding of what audio has been captured once, or presumably once it's been transcribed. How mature would you say the TalkIQ/Dialpad solution is in terms of the NLU piece, natural language understanding, once the natural language has been processed?
Yeah. So, you know, going to business school, everyone always tells you to answer, start a question with "it depends." So I will say, you know, it depends. So we have industry leading accuracy in terms of transcription quality. And so I think when you get into so let's take NLU and NLP, meaning I can start to understand sentiment, or I can start to do things like topic classification. If you don't have high accuracy on the transcription piece, it basically becomes garbage in, garbage out, right? If you have poor transcription, your ability to understand sentiment or identify topics or competitor names, whatever it might be, becomes much harder. So it all starts with, hey, you've got to go make sure that you've got industry leading accuracy on that. So we do monthly benchmarking. We outperform Google, Amazon Lex, Speechmatix, you name it, folks that are out there. So we get really, really good transcription quality. The next piece gets into the NLP and on U piece. And so, as I said, that piece is how do you start to build flywheel effects as well to actually increase the accuracy of that? Meaning, we never tell somebody when we make a suggestion or we map sentiment or identify topics, whatever it might be. These are all features that we have. We constantly ping the user to say, hey, are we accurate on that suggestion or that recommendation? We never say, here's what is happening in the call. We say, you know, here's what we think is happening. Here's what we think you're talking about, and asking for that user input, because that user input ultimately becomes labeled training data for us to then go back and start to understand and make tweaks to the models that we're using. So that's one of the things and kind of the tricks to AI and these technologies is we're still in the early innings. I would put us at kind of the second, third innings in terms of where we are today, meaning you can get really, really accurate transcription. And then you can start to get some really basic understanding of what's happening in the call. And when I say basic understanding, that doesn't mean that it's not helpful. It means that you can start to understand sentiment analysis. You can start to do some category and topic identification. You can start to route calls based on what is happening. You can start providing suggested answers to questions. It's not going to be perfect every time, because if you think of these conversations, we go in so many different directions and there's so many things going on, you're still teaching a computer how to understand that. And so I would put us at like still second or third innings in terms of where we're at today. And that can solve some really, really immense challenging problems for businesses today and add immense value. And then I think about the opportunities ahead and I'm like, when we talk about the excitement or the opportunities of how do we automate workflows and what the future looks like, it all starts with basically ASR, automated speech recognition, NLP, NLU, and then continuing to mature.
So I opened the discussion with two cliches. Admittedly, they're cliches, but I think they work pretty well. AI is the new UI and voice is the new app. And it sounds like we share a common vision for that. So we're in the second or third inning today. When does the game end? When is the ninth inning when, let's say, you know, voice is the predominant computing interface?
Yeah. When I think about the future, you know, I can see us sitting in an office. You know, the future may look different today, but I can say, you know, sitting, you know, we have some experience, whether it's sort of video conferencing or whether we're in person. And I do think there's an opportunity where we will have digital assistants that are omnipresent and live in a room and can do things for us. Meaning, oftentimes we get into a business meeting and somebody will ask about a data point. And usually that requires somebody to then open up a spreadsheet and start scrolling around to find the data point. I do believe in a future where all of these systems will be seamlessly integrated together. And then on top of them will be your digital assistant, right? Because voices go, we see it today. But if people don't think that voice is the net input for our devices, it's only starting to propagate in our consumer lives. We've yet to see it really show up in our business lives. But I do think you'll be able to speak out loud of, hey, let me book a room, or let me actually go and get this data point from my Domo, you know, from my data warehouse or wherever it might be. But I also think it'll get into being able to do things for us that there's a lot of friction today. So if we ran out of time and you and I are talking to say, hey, we're plugged into the calendars, I know Dan and Dan are free next Wednesday at 2 p.m. Let us go and actually, you know, solve that and suggest a time and book it. There are unicorn businesses today that are built on just reducing the friction around calendar events, right? So I do think there's just even those seamless opportunities to go and solve.
In the AI field, we talk about narrow AI, which is where we're at today, as opposed to general AI, which is the ability for AI to do anything, perform any task that a human could do. I agree with you that today, you know, what we'll call narrow AI for things like scheduling or named entity recognition, being able to extract dates and times and math and things like that from arbitrary speech, I'd say generously we're there today. What's your sense of where the full spectrum of speech will be understood in a bunch of domains by one AI?
Yeah, I think that is a terribly complex, challenging problem. And I see you shaking your head. And I think there's a couple of examples of it. One is you can hear Elon Musk talk about, you know, the difficulties in self-driving. It turns out that self-driving is a lot more difficult than he thought. And I don't think any of us are terribly surprised at that. And I think that's a reality, as much as we think of, you know, this amazing future where I never have to drive again and it's going to be perfectly safe. Turns out that there's a lot more unpredictability that shows up in the road than we might take for granted. The same thing happens. I think AI today does a very, very good job on things that are simple and things that are frequent. And I think when you think about a future to say, hey, could I go and build a fully automated agent? And would I never need another salesperson or another service agent or customer support person? I would say absolutely not. I think it would be very, very difficult. I'm curious to see if we'll actually even accomplish it in our lifetime to have something that is that smart, because I think we're incredibly complex kind of beings on our ability to think and be flexible and adapt to what is happening. And machines today with the technologies are not terribly adapt at changing paths and flexibility and adjusting on the fly to real life things that are happening. So today, I think the technologies do really, really well on, as I said, frequent and fairly basic tasks. Again, topic classification, things to that. And I think there are some, we need to see that technologies continue to evolve. And I think they've evolved immensely over the past kind of even 5 years, but over the past 10 years. And I do think there's going to be some immense opportunities that open up, but I think these are very, very real complex problems. And we have to make sure that we level set the expectations, but I'm really excited about all of this and how it shakes out.
So some of the solutions in the space that I mentioned, whether it's a Twilio or certainly a Zoom plus Five9, they're commanding, again, just stratospheric valuations. When you look at the opportunity based on this kind of shared future that we envision, specifically for Dialpad, what are some of the adjacent opportunities that you think, 10x or 1000x the value that Dialpad can bring to customers?
Yeah. I think the biggest, I never thought of myself as showing up in kind of the cloud telephony telecom world. But I think there's an immense problem and opportunity to solve for how do you power voice, video, messaging across any device, anywhere in the world, right? And especially today, as we go through a pandemic and have so many people working in different places, that alone is a really, really big challenge. So there's not a bigger market that's out there in terms of, how do we power communication for anybody in the world, especially in business. And then I think the biggest opportunity really gets into this idea of the future of how do we start to automate workflows and help businesses understand what's happening in these conversations. And to me, it's really why I'm in this space and, why we were building TalkIQ is I think that's a bigger market than powering communications. I think it solves all of these tiny little friction points that we have, as I said, even down to calendaring events to, how do I get on a phone call faster and know a little bit more about Dan? And once if you and I were talking and it actually bubbled up our LinkedIn profiles or said, hey, this is the last thing you guys spoke about, all of these opportunities. But to me, I think that's the opportunity that's out there is, help businesses understand voice as a data set, and then how do we automate the workflows of the future and reduce friction that they're going to experience on a day-to-day basis?
So you had a great run at Google, one of obviously the most iconic companies, certainly in Silicon Valley, certainly a unique culture of innovation. Talk us through what are some of the lessons that you took from Google into TalkIQ that helped you?
Yeah, so it's very fortunate to, so I had joined Google in early 2003. So it was almost right after that. I don't know how many people remember this, I'm dating myself, but you've got the tech bust that happened in 02. And so when I joined Google, it was not the Google that I think many of us know and experience today. We were less than 300 employees. You had sales and engineering in a single office. As I said, that's why I got to sit next to I call him PD, Brian Peterson. I was the founder of Dialpad, but you've got sales and engineering sitting next to each other, talking to each other on those pieces. And I don't think I appreciated at the time, and I was there for 9.5 years, but how do you scale? I think was obviously a big learning. How do you lead with humility and respect? How do you drive accountability and performance, but do that, as I said, in a way that has compassion for people? And I think as I kind of mature in my own career, those to me have been the biggest learnings is really starting to pay attention to just the immense scale and how to architect and communicate and set the expectations for people appropriately. And then two is how to lead. And I was very fortunate to work with, Sheryl Sandberg and David Fisher and Emily White and Grady Burnett. There's all of these people that have gone on to just fantastic careers. And at that time, I didn't realize, I was like, oh, this is an all-star lineup. It's like showing up on the 96 Bulls and not quite realizing just how good of a team you're learning from. But those were some of the learnings for sure.
So I got to ask the inverse of that question is what are some of the lessons that you needed to unlearn from Google when you started TalkIQ?
I think when you work at any business for that long, as I said, it was almost a 10-year run, which is a long time. I think you get you, especially if it's a world-class business and a big business, and then you step into kind of the startup world, you have to then realize how to get a little bit scrappier for yourself and make harder decisions, because you don't have all of the resources. You don't have all of the support. Money is not going to solve your problems, especially if you're at a startup, right? You may not have that much money on those pieces. So those were some of the learnings, which was, hey, every person that's there in a startup, I think, opts into the startup, but knows that they're going to have to do a little bit more, right? Whether it's a little bit work, a little bit harder, be a little bit scrappier because they don't have those resources and support. And initially, those were some of the things. Those were some of the things that I had to unlearn. The other things got into as Google got large, and this is not a knock on Google by any means. I feel incredibly fortunate for the experience that I had there, was how to maintain a connection with people. And that's something that really stuck out to me. I remember this specific moment when I was at Google, and there's a VP at the time that came in to kind of do like a walk around of our group, and just didn't spend any time connecting with the people. It was a very business oriented kind of QBR, and it's very short. And I remember sitting in the room kind of 5 minutes before it, and they showed up and they were too busy doing emails and not even engaging. And I specifically remember at that meeting and just saying, I don't want to ever kind of be seen like that. And it really just felt like I didn't matter, and you're kind of just the cog in the wheel. And that's something also that I've just taken with me as kind of a thing to unlearn, which is like, hey, don't, no matter how senior or where you progress in your career, remember that there are people paying attention that might be, you know, technically lower than you by title or whatever that means. But how do you actually lead with compassion and spend time with them in the moment that they're there? Because it probably has a more profound effect than you think.
Hearing that example makes me think about what an amazingly humbling experience it is to be an entrepreneur. And I'm sure you, like me, you know, attribute, you know, a lot of what you've learned to mentors and role models. And I was thinking back to, I think we share a common role model in gentleman named Rory O'Driscoll, who was on your board. Yeah. And he was a guest on the podcast and is always colorful and I think brilliant in terms of reading a market. Talk to us about your role models, your mentors, and how they've impacted your career.
Two people immediately come to mind. One is a gentleman by the name of Wesley Chan, who's a product marketer at Google, and it's also now a successful venture capitalist. And anytime I need career advice or help, I usually go to Wes. Wes is somebody that I talk to frequently and has had just an immense impact in terms of shaping my career, helping me make what I think are reasonably good decisions in terms of opportunities, how to think about opportunities, how to make decisions around investments or priorities around product decisions. And I think the other one is really Craig, who's our CEO today. And we have just a really fantastic relationship and an open relationship where he gives me a lot of rein on responsibilities and openness. And I think, you know, anytime I look for, I never actually kind of seeked out a mentor to say, like, I've never sat down with Craig or Wes and said, like, hey, will you be my mentor? And this is what it means. I know people kind of give that guidance. I think there's people that you naturally connect with. And I think you naturally connect with them because they've got the same value kind of communication style. You think that you look up to them because they've been obviously successful. And so they seem to be able to make some good decisions, whether that's all luck or they actually do make a decision, whatever it might be, probably a combination of both. But the two of them really resonate with me in terms of values, how they see the world, opportunities, decision-making, and then, almost most importantly, experiences that they've had. You know, this is, Craig's built three businesses. He sold one to Yahoo, one to Google. This is his third one. So I'm kind of like, oh, if I want to be an entrepreneur, that's a pretty good entrepreneur to go and learn from.
So we're about out of time, but before I can let you off the hot seat, I got one more question I got to get in. And that's, what's your advice for a younger version of Dan?
Take more risks. And that's probably a very cliched one to say, is especially in your career, especially if you're in tech, that I think people knowing when you feel complacent, trusting that the world will invest in you and work itself out, and that you're probably a lot more capable than you believe. And those are things like, you know, I had a great run at Google just to kind of bring it home. I wish I had left Google probably 4 years before I did. And I look back and I don't have a lot of regrets, but those are ones where I'm like, like if I had done that, where would I have been? And I think those are things, especially in tech, I see people and they get a little bit worried about taking risks. And I think especially people that are early in their careers or even not, you know, I'm not terribly young anymore. But I think like you had to continue to take risks, like you never know, life is short. There's just tons of opportunities and I definitely believe that the world will work itself out for you if you take those risks.
Did you think that you were taking a big risk in 2003 when you joined that startup called Google?
What's funny about that is I didn't think it was a huge risk, and namely because I was 22, I'm trying to think back, I was 22, 23 years old at that time. The tech bust had happened. So I was literally solving for two things. One is I wanted to work in technology, and this sounds kind of funny to say. I was also looking for a paycheck, but people forget that back at that time, that crash was so bad that there were so many businesses that were basically doing unpaid internships for people. And so those were two things. And then I looked at it as not a huge risk to go and join a startup. I grew up in Silicon, in the heart of Silicon Valley in Saratoga, which is literally down the street from Apple's headquarters. And so I always knew that, hey, there's risk in technologies, but I never viewed Google as like a huge risk simply because I always wanted to join a small startup at the time.
Well, it worked out okay. Dan, we're out of time. This has been such a pleasure. I really enjoyed this conversation. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was awesome. Thank you so much.
Okay. Well, all the best to you and, of course, the Dialpad. This is your host, Dan Turchin, signing off for this week, but back next week with another fascinating guest.